White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker on a Freya's Day, Friday, She-Wolf Day in the bunker. February the 13th, all day long, and it's colder than a... Anyhow, it was about 3 degrees above zero when I got up this morning, and I'm telling you, that's a little bit too cold for me. I'm going to have to figure a way getting into the southern climes one of these days. Hey, I went over to the Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern last night. Sometimes I go over there, have a couple of drinks, and sometimes they ask me to sing a song. So I said, well, I'll sing you a song. What do you want to hear? They said, we want to hear you sing a Bobby Bear song, An All-American Boy. I said, okay, give me that microphone, give me that guitar, let's do it.
Buy a guitar, put it through, you'll be rockin' and rollin' soon. Impress that girl. Picking hot licks and all that jazz. Well, I bought me a guitar a year ago. Learned how to play it in a day or so. All around town it was well understood that I was knocking them out like Johnny B. Goode. Hot licks, showing off. Ah, number one. Yeah, I practiced all day and up into the night. My papa's hair was turning white. If he didn't like that rock and roll, he said, you can say, boy, but that's gotta go. He just swears. He just doesn't dig me at all. So I took my guitar, picked it all, bid farewell to my world fall. Split for Memphis where they send you all, and them swinging cats are having a ball. Session, hot lips and all, they dig me. Well, I was rocking and a bopping and I was getting a break. The girls all said that I had what it takes. But up stepped the man with a big cigar and said, come on, cat, I'm going to make you a star. I'll put you on bandstand, buy you a Cadillac, sign here, kid. Well, I signed my name, became a star, having a ball with my guitar, driving a big, long Cadillac, and fighting a girl over my back. They just kept a-coming, screaming, yeah, they liked it. So I picked my guitar with a great big grin, and the money just kept coming on in. And then one day, my Uncle Sam, he said, here I am. Uncle Sam needs you, boy. I'm gonna cut your hair off. Ah, take this rifle, kid. Give me that guitar. Yeah, we're going to Afghanistan. You ready? Get in that truck, boy. We're going to kill some Arabs.
Well, there you go, boys. Took him about a six-pack of beer to get me up there and get me doing that stuff. But I do like to do it, I'll tell you that. Yeah, that Bobby Bear song goes way back to almost my high school days, back when they were getting ready to shove us into Vietnam. Yeah. Righto. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And then go up to our big, big, big giant website, resist.com, and check it out now. We're doing some streaming of the old shows, so see what's cooking there. I think you're going to like that. You can tell your friends. They can listen to the White Area and Resistance radio archives all night long. That's right. Well, I see the warmonger Republicans are hard at it. We got to go to war someplace. You just get it sort of tamed down at one spot and they're ready to go to another. They want to take on ISIL now. I wish they'd send all these goddamn congressmen and senators over there and give them a rifle, boy. Take this rifle, congressman. Give me that guitar. Send them over there. They want to clean them out. They don't like ISIL. Let them fight them. Let them fight them. This is an Arab problem. This is a Muslim problem. This is not my problem, not your problem. And so, I tell you, the way these voters around here go, they love war. They say they hate war and they love peace of Jesus Christ. But then the next time you hear them, well, we got to go over there and defend all those people. We got to fight our ass off and die for those people. Well, hell, they're fighting their ass off and dying for themselves. They kill each other all the time, man. They like that sport among the Muslims. Of course, if we weren't there occupying and running the show, I'm sure they would pacify a little bit. Especially if we quit sending all those U.S.-made weapons over there. Yeah, I don't see anybody out demonstrating against that. Hey, you want to start a war? Oh, we'll send you all the weapons you want because we want your money because we're the weapons of mass destruction people, man. We make them. We produce them and we get them out there and so you can really kick ass. Well, I see they may have a deal in eastern Ukraine. Well, I hope so, because there's a hell of a lot of civilians getting killed. I think they said about 5,000 at least. And I'll bet you most of them were civilians. They just love to kill civilians. Well, we'll get you and I'll get you, but in between are the civilians. To me, as far as I'm concerned, when you kill civilians, that's a war crime, no matter what your reason is. Did you see that they started that trial for the guy that shot Mr. Super Sniper and his buddy? I'm telling you what, my question is, was that guy near this uranium ammunition and dust clouds and powder and burning the dumps where that uranium were in? I want to see every guy that goes off the tracks like that checked out, because chances are he's got uranium poisoning. If he was over there, it's all over the place. You can't stay away from it. They're breathing it in through the dust and everything. Just like that crap in Fallujah, where most of the kids being born have all kinds of birth defects and once in a while different, you know, two heads and everything else due to that wonderful peacemaking Washington. The Warmongers Incorporated. That's it. That's all they are, boys. And they should not be casting stones at prisoners in the prisons over here, because none of the guys in prison over here have killed as many people as the U.S. government and the Pentagon and all that stuff have done, right? Look at George Bush Jr. And Cheney. What miserable sons of bitches they are, and they should be in The Hague being tried. And now Obama's doing similar things, you know, with his drones, just picking out spots on the ground. He thinks he knows who they are. Blast them, blast them. Any weapon used against people in foreign countries eventually will be used against the citizens of the United States. Just remember that, all you war hawk Christians out there and conservative Republicans that are always saber-rattling. Well, I see a black person had some good fortune here. It's a so-called young mother with cerebral palsy wins $188 million Powerball jackpot. Well, I understand. But I'd rather have seen a white person get it. Well, as I keep telling you, the Christian Zionist sheep are being sheared by the millions. Mega churches and wealthy pastors are a popular staple in Christian community these days. As seen on TV, these preachers have private jet planes, fancy suits, million-dollar houses, luxurious cars, and the like. But who are the wealthiest preachers out there? Well, we'll see. Wait a minute here. Let's see. Let me get my stuff straight here. Creflo Augustus Dollar Jr. Now you can imagine what race he is a televangelist pastor who is the founder of the non-denominational church known as World Changers International. His net worth is $27 million. Also hosts a television show called Changing Your World. Okay, let's see here. There's more to this. Dollar has often been criticized for his lavish lifestyle. He should be more than that. He should be in jail. That's this tax exemption is what leads to this. There should be no tax exemption for churches. His assets include two Rolls Royces, a private jet, and $2.5 million apartment in Manhattan. Whoa, yeah. A Nigerian preacher who is considered one of the richest preachers in the world, David Oyedepo, has reported net worth of $150 million. He's not sharing his money with Jesus. He is the presiding bishop and founder of the Faith Church Worldwide, also known as the Winner's Chapel, having its headquarters in Ogun State of Nigeria. Jeez, that country is so poor they don't know what to do. But he's got plenty, man. The report says, and you know the Christian fundamentalists, they took this religion over there to Africa. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, there was hardly any of it there, but all these Christian sects invaded Africa, and they've got these people hooked on that another drug, like they need a drug. The report says that Oyedepo owns a mansion in London and the U.S., along with his four private jets. He owns a Dominion publishing house, which publishes all his books, which are mostly on the subject of prosperity. More than half the population of Nigeria, Oyedepo's home country, live below the poverty line on $2 a day. Yeah. Here's another one. Eddie Long. Eddie Long is the senior pastor of the New Birth Baptist Missionary Church in Georgia. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution published in 2005, Long received more than $3.7 million of compensation and benefits from his nonprofit charity, Bishop Eddie Long Ministries Incorporated. The newspaper investigation included that Long's assets included a real estate property of $1.4 million, a $350,000 Bentley car, and a salary of more than $1 million, including $494,000 in the year 2000. The average annual income of the residents of the church hometown, Lithonia, Georgia, is $25,154 a year. This Nigerian minister is the founder of this guy's name, Christian Oyaka Hailom. This Nigerian minister is the founding president of Believers Love World Incorporated, headquartered in Lagos, Nigeria. Oyakhilome's assets are worth about $50 million. His church in Lagos has more than 40,000 members. Most of them are successful business executives and politicians, and you wonder why African people are always poor. The main source of income to Oyakhilome is through his business, which comprises of newspapers, magazines, a television station, satellite TV, hotels, and real estate. The next on the list is Bishop T.D. Jakes. Thomas Dexter Jakes Sr. is the bishop of the Potter's House, a non-denominational megachurch with about 30,000 members. The Texas pastor's net worth is $18 million. He's earned his wealth being the chief pastor of Potter's House. The Trinity Broadcasting Network and BET both air his services. And Evangelicus Sermons, he's been called America's best preacher by Time Magazine, has been featured on its cover. He lives in a $1.7 million mansion in suburban Dallas. The average Medium income in the community serves is $56,954 a year. The next religious criminal is T.B. Joshua. Tematope Bolagun Joshua is the founder of the Synagogue of the Church of All Nations. He's one of the richest black preachers in the world with a net worth of $15 million. SOCAN has over 15,000 members. It has branches in Ghana, UK, South Africa, Greece. SOCAN runs a Christian television station called Emmanuel TV. The next crook is Bishop Charles Edward Blake, Sr., served as the presiding bishop of the Church of God in Christ, a 6 million member denomination. He earns a salary of $900,000 a year and lives in a 10,000 square foot mansion in Beverly Hills. His church boasts 20,000 members per week. You know, I have absolutely no sympathy at all for people so stupid as to buy into this shit. And I have no sympathy at all for the people not to do something about it. And of course, Washington, once they put tax exemption in on these bastards, they all piled in. But none of our people, so-called right-wingers, white separatists, like Butler or even Dr. Pierce, could ever get tax exemption. The median salary income of South Los Angeles is $27,907. The next one is Matthew Ashimolo is a senior pastor of Kingsway International Christian Center in London. His net worth is about $10 million. These people are worse than the Jews. These preachers like this are worse than the Jews. Anybody want to argue about that? Ashimolo earned his wealth from various businesses like Matthew Ashimolo Media, which sells documentaries and Christian literature. Ashimolo's home country is Nigeria. Boy, these Nigerians, these are the ones that operate all this shit that you want $1 million, and all you have to do is get in touch with them and they'll help you collect it. 55% of the population lives below the poverty level of under $2 a day. I think that is the end of that short list, but it goes on and on and on. I'd like to see all those goddamn preachers hung by the neck until dead. I don't know how many are fighting over there in Ukraine, but there's a whole lot of so-called neo-Nazis fighting over there that are out of their minds, Hollywood Nazis, who, like usual, think they're doing something good, fighting for the EU and the Jews that run it against the Russian minority in eastern Ukraine. Too bad private citizens can't send weapons over there to the eastern Ukraine, because I'd be happy to send them a couple. But you know what would happen if I tried that. Well, anyhow, it's not only is the term neo-Nazi a fake term, press-oriented, press-generated, but now they use the term to say that these people, supposed neo-Nazis, and of course, like I've told you, most of the time CIA has controlled these so-called neo-Nazis, and I can prove some of it that I've told you about before. They're no more National Socialists than my dog. In fact, I think my dog is much more National Socialist than they are. Let's check this out. This came from Germany. If one compares the strategy described by Ischinger and Merkel being applied against Russia, one realizes that there is a major difference today to that of the confrontation of the two systems. The Western militaries are no longer constrained at the earlier borders separating the Federal Republic of Germany from the German Democratic Republic. In the Baltic countries, they are regularly operating on territories that have been part of the Soviet Union. Ukraine and Georgia provide them with access to former Soviet territory where they're making their maneuvers. in eastern Ukraine Civil War neo-Nazi battalions, eight of them, are fighting alongside the West against Russia. Moscow views all this militarily as happening on its last lines of defense, which it must secure at all costs if it does not intend to completely give up its national sovereignty. With its provocations staged along these lines of defense, the West is not merely playing with fire, it is playing with the conflagration of a much larger scale war. Well, as far as I'm concerned, these so-called right-wing neo-Nazis are going to get their due from the Russians. And I support the Russians, just like I supported the Serbians in that bloodbath over there. Let me reiterate. Let me reiterate that if you know anybody or any organization that's involved in supplying troops to this eastern Ukrainian struggle, advise them to get out, because this influence and manipulation by the CIA has gone on for a long time, several decades, all the way back to the Rhodesian conflict. And several of so-called National Socialists from this country went over there to so-called fight against whoever, the Negroes. But it was a total setup by the CIA. I know Harold Covington was one of them that went over there. And I think they still got his, may have their fingers into his pie. So some of these guys, I think, are coming from the skinheads in England and maybe Germany and France thinking, I don't know what they're thinking, because I don't even think they're thinking. They want to fight something. They're still fighting the Cold War when the Soviet Union was the opposition. They're still living in that time. But if you know any of these guys or can influence any of them to get out, because in many cases they're going to die for the wrong side. That's for sure. The Hollywood Nazis are being closely monitored and guided and influenced by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. And they've been involving so-called National Socialists in this country, which I call Hollywood Nazis, into the inner workings of various African states for at least 40 years, maybe more. Well, let's get back into the Bible, the Devil's Book. There was another expression of mental strength that was typical of heathendom, and that has lived on as a part of folk culture, even after Christianization. It is what we may call common sense, the quality of being quick-witted. In popular fairy tales, for instance, the hero is not only brave, often he is also a bright little chap with a lot of common sense. This kind of horse sense can also be found in the poetic Eddas, especially in the poem of Havamal that contains much down-to-earth wisdom. It begins with the following advice, quote, "Look at all doors before you enter them. Observe them, for you cannot know whether your enemy is lying in wait for you there in the hall," unquote. In strophe 14, it goes like this, "Then beer is at its best when the man brings back home all of his intellect," unquote. In other words, don't drink too much. This poem, Havamal, does not contain the high-flown metaphysical wisdom. The only intention it is to make the reader stronger, more alert, by giving him all kinds of advice, simple-sounding as it often may seem to be at first sight. Some of these simple-sounding counsels and other pieces of folk wisdom express keen powers of observation and the ability to say something in a laconic but clear way. Take, for instance, the old Flemish folk saying, quote, "A horse that has eaten enough kicks away his bucket," unquote. Or this one, the dirtiest pigs want to sleep in the cleanest straw, unquote. How many complicated sentences with difficult words our modern sociologists and psychologists would need before they could elucidate the same ideas? There are many more examples that show how society in old heathen Europe aimed at making people mentally strong. The heathens wanted their children to be courageous in life, valiant in battle, and capable of facing death without fear. They wanted people who stood firm, who had common sense, and who took an optimistic view of life. After this, it cannot be surprising that the old Europeans inspired awe in the contemporary historians because of their mental and also physical strength. Roman general Julius Caesar, in his account of his campaign in Gaul, had these remarks on the Nervi, a Belgic tribe of Teutonic origin. The Nervi refused to make peace with Caesar, which in fact meant that they refused to subject themselves to him. When Caesar, who writes about himself in a third person, made inquiries about their nature and their customs, he found the merchants were not allowed in their territory. They didn't tolerate wine or any article to be imported among them, for they thought this caused bravery and energy to be weakened. They were wild, brave men who scolded fiercely the other Belgic tribes because they had been subjected themselves to the Romans and had put aside ancestral valor. They assured that they would not send envoys and that they would not submit to any peace requirements, unquote. The people whom the Romans esteemed the most were the Teutons. These same Caesar accounts how his soldiers, although they were not easily frightened, were suddenly seized by terror during a stay in Besançon when they heard the local Gauls telling stories about the Teutons. Quote, when he, Caesar, was staying at Besantia for some days, he stocked up on corn and other provisions. The army was suddenly seized by such terror that it completely bewildered everybody. The cause of this was a talk by the Gauls and the merchants, who declared that with much ado that the Teutons were distinguished by their gigantic stature, their unbelievable bravery, and their skill in the art of war. They pretended that they had communicated with them several times and that they had been unable to bear their countenance and their piercing look. At first, panic arose among the tribunes, the prefects, and all the others that had left Rome and followed Caesar to acquire or keep his favor, but who were not very experienced in the art of war. All of them gave a different motive, which, so they pretended, compelled them to go away, and they asked his permission to leave the army. Unquote. The strange thing with Christianity, each people, or every movement that wants to make progress, is looking for followers with much mental strength in order to support the group strategy. This is even more true when it comes to fighting, for it obviously does not make sense to go to battle with weaklings. This rule, you know, I noticed too, down through the years, all these observable National Socialists and National Socialist parties that have been here in the United States, almost all of them are out of shape. Fat, pot belly, fat hanging down, fat ass, or skinny, no muscle tone at all. And they put on the uniform and they think that makes them strong. This rule also applies for movements like those which are based on the biblical doctrine, Judaism, Islam, as well as National Socialism and Communism, put a lot of work into training combative and fearless followers. Disciplined youth movements, ardent speeches by leaders, simulated marching music, martial uniforms, and the glorification of heroism and martyrdom. These ideologies do their utmost to recruit vigorous militants. The results were or are impressing, for it was and is not pleasant to have to fight these ideologies. they were and are trained to combat with degree of fanaticism that is worthy of a better cause. But this general rule does not go for all the Bible ideologies. Indeed, it is a fact that Christianity with post-Christianity following in its wake has a nature that with regard to this matter differs completely from the other members of the Bible Club. Christianity is the odd man out here. It is to be sure undeniable that Christianity in the glorious days of the church was as vigorous and ardent conquering as, for instance, communism or Islam. But the true philosophy of Christianity as it's manifested itself in the New Testament is not like that at all. This true Christianity has no intention of filling its followers with mental strength and fighting spirit. It has the goal of making them weak and defenseless. Christians are taught to endure anything. Thus, the Son of Yahweh addresses his disciples, quote, "Go your way. Behold, I send you forth as lambs among the wolves." Famous is this command of his, quote, "But I say, unite you, that ye resist no evil. But whatsoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also," unquote. Elsewhere he declares, "Love your enemies, do good to them which hate you, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which deceitfully or despitefully use you." In the same spirit, his disciple Peter preaches to the Christians in Asia Minor, quote, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only the good and the gentle, but also to the forward. For this is thanksworthy. If a man for conscience towards God endure grief, suffering wrongfully, for what glory is it if when he is buffeted for your faith, ye shall take it patiently? But if and when you do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently. This is acceptable with God." Talk about a slave religion. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ recites the so-called 8 salvations. This, too, can hardly be explained as an incitement to valor or fighting spirit. Quote, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs shall be the kingdom of heaven," unquote. "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they who do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." A good heathen sermon on the mount might have sounded like this: "Blessed are the clever in spirit, for happily for them the kingdom of heaven shall not be theirs. Blessed are the cheerful, for they don't need to be comforted. Blessed are the people with fighting spirit, for they shall conquer the earth. Blessed are they who don't hunger and thirst after religiousness, but who enforce it. Blessed are they who are not merciful, because they want to obtain mercy themselves, but who are merciful when it is appropriate to be merciful. Blessed are they with scars in their heart from fighting against evil, for happily for them they will not see Yahweh. Blessed are they who will not be called the children of Yahweh. Blessed are they whose persecutors suffer for righteousness' sake, for theirs is indeed the kingdom of heaven, the real heaven," unquote. The question one should ask now is, what strange movement is it that wants its followers to be meek? What a strange movement it is that sends its militants as lambs before the wolves. There appears to be only one logical answer. This answer is only the enemy of a certain group has an interest in it, that a movement is created inside this very group which undermines the fighting spirit of this group. For it is obvious that this enemy prefers a group whose members turn to them their left cheek when they are smitten on their right, to a group whose members strike back twice as hard. In other words, in this line of thought, Christianity would have been, and still is, a kind of Trojan horse in heathen Europe, placed into our midst to undermine the strength of the mind of the Europeans, with the aim of making things easier for our enemies to subjugate us. This may seem to be a rather far-fetched scenario, certainly in the eyes of the people with European roots, who are not used to thinking in these categories, and who are average less intelligent than, for instance, Jew people. But it's that very scenario which Jewish author Marcus Eli Ravitch described to an American periodical in 1928. Probably this happened to fit an overconfidence brought about in the same period after the takeover of the Soviet Union by his co-religionists, when the sun seemed to shine for Jewish people everywhere in the world. Here is the relevant quotation. Only after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD, the new belief, Christianity, started to win respect. A patriotic Jew called Paulus, or Sallust, hit on the idea of breaking the moral backbone of the Roman soldiers by means of doctrine of love and pacifism, preached by a small Jewish sect in order to force Rome to its knees and humiliate it. He became the apostle of the heathens, and the very person who had been up to then one of the most zealous persecutors of that gang of Christians. Paulus did it so well that 400 years later, this huge empire, which had conquered Palestine and half the world, had become a heap of rubble, and the law of Moses, which had gone out from Zion, became the state religion of Rome. Big talk or reality? This is an impossible question to answer after so many centuries. But anyhow, it is in fact that Paulus and his followers turned Christianity, which initially was just another Jewish sect, into a new religion that was no longer related to Jewry. They suddenly started to address themselves explicitly to the heathens, causing the Jew in the street, who apparently did not understand what was going on, to rage with anger, as one can read in the book of Acts. The question is why it suddenly occurred to Paulus and his disciples to address themselves to the heathens. What on earth could have prompted members of the chauvinistic Jewish sect, which the Christians originally were, to make a 180-degree change and to suddenly start caring about these same non-Jews? Was it loving kindness, or was it something else? No, they hated their guts. Secondly, it was certain that the period of beginning of Christianity coincided with the period of the great Jewish uprising against the Romans and the suppression of it, culminating in the conquest of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in the year 70 AD. Messianic expectations concerning future world dominion played a role in this rebellion. It is not unlikely that in this atmosphere of rebellion and messianic dreams, some Jewish thinkers had been brainstorming about sophisticated strategies to force the Romans to their knees. One of these could have been the idea of tainting them with a new religion, which would undermine their mental strength. To get more on that, you should read, what's that book about Rome? I'll try to think of it. The Fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbons. Read Gibbons about how crazy the Christians were in Rome. They were committing suicide, wanting to go to heaven and everything else. They were running through the streets, causing havoc, much like the Negroes do in the ghetto. If so, it would have been an example of far-sighted strategic thinking, but maybe it does not seem so unrealistic to expect this of people who dream of something as far-fetching as world dominion. Well, I believe it totally that the Jews have used Christianity as a weapon, of course, every day. However, the sequel to this story was that once Christianity had taken power in the Western world, it became more or less a normal movement, which means a movement needing militants with fighting spirit and mental strength. In this way, Christianity as practice came into collision with true Christianity of the gospel. The typical popular fairy tale usually ends with the heroine or the hero being rewarded for her or his heroic deed, with the hand of the handsome prince or the beautiful princess. The last sentence often tells us that they lived a long and happy life and had many children. From this, it seems sensible to conclude that the society which produced these educational stories explicitly, purposely, put forward love between man and woman as the highest reward and therefore as the supreme good. We do not know for sure when and where this society existed. But is this not exactly the kind of society one would expect to have existed in a golden age? This love ideal apparently lived in the classical antiquity. How less rosy than the world of fairy tales this era might have seen or been. This is, for instance, evident from the fact that in the heathen literature of that time, love is an important theme, the second most important after heroism. Take, for instance, the Odyssey. Maybe some people do not like the cunning protagonist Odysseus, but that does not alter the fact that the whole book radiates only one desire, the longing by Odysseus to return home and see his wife Penelope and his son Telemachos again, but only after 20 years, 10 years of the Trojan War and 10 years of the wanderings, the gods finally granted him permission to be reunited with his wife, who has remained loyal to him during that whole period of time. Quote, but eventually the year had come in the wheel of time in which the gods permitted him to return home to Ithaca, unquote. The second masterwork, the beautiful novel Daphnis and Chloe, of Greek author Longus in the 3rd century, on the love between two foundlings, has inspired many European poets and writers from the Renaissance up until the 19th century. This book is prototype of pastoral romance. Another famous love story from the heathen times is that of Tristan and Iseult, which has come to us in various medieval versions, but which originally goes back to raw material of old Celtic times, the so-called Matière de Bretagne. I don't pronounce those words very well. Who is not acquainted with the outcome of this story? How the tragic couple was buried in one and the same grave, on which later a rose bush and a branch of a vine intertwined. The tough world of old Teutons too had its romantic moments. A less known example is the poem Helgavida, and there's another word there I can't pronounce, of the poetic Edda. In this poem, the story is told by the king named Helgi, who fell on the battlefield when still young. He was buried in a grave mound. One evening, a maid of his widow, Sigrun, saw the dead king riding into the mound with a large retinue. She notified her mistress of what she had seen. The widow rushed to the burial mound and indeed find her husband there, who had returned to this world for one night. Sigrun said, quote, his coming fills me with so much joy, like Odin's hawk longing for prey, looking for the warm flesh which covers with dew. He sees the dawn breaking. First I will kiss the dead king before he undoes the bloody armor. Your hair, Helgi, is completely rimmed. You are covered with the dew of wounds, and chilly are the king's hands. How, Helgi, can I heal your sorrow? Unquote. They spent one more night together. Towards the morning, Helgi had to announce his return to the other world, which people in those times used to locate according to a certain tradition far away in the ocean. in the west. That other world is Valhalla, the hall of the slain, the Teutonic heaven where all the heroes are going. Thus spoke Helgi. Quote, now I must ride at the crack of dawn, at full speed on the dun horse. Anew, I must dwell behind the western horizon, before crowing of the cock wakes up the heroes. Unquote. The next day at sunset, Sigrun returned to the burial mound, but Helgi did not show up. The poem ends with this sentence. Sigrun lived but a short time because of her sorrow. Unquote. Tales like that of Tristan and Yesal appeal to the imagination of the Europeans throughout history. From the Middle Ages, the era of ideal of courtly love, up to the Romantic movement, the very name of which calls to mind love, the atmosphere of swan lakes, moonshine, and the smell of roses. All this was reflected in literature, music, ballet, opera, and other art forms. You notice we've lost most of this entirely, especially in the United States. A great many of our old folk songs are likewise imbued with this old heathen love ideal. Take, for instance, this typical old Flemish song of Gustave and Melanie. This song, somewhat clumsy and bombastic as it is, begins as follows. True love is afraid of nothing. It triumphs through fair and foul, like Melanie, a count's daughter, an only child, very rich in money and goods. This pure maiden of noble descent sets her whole heart on a foundling, on Gustav. She sets her mind, an orphan who knows neither father nor mother. Unquote. Characteristic of this kind of folk songs is the moral lesson at the end. Quote, take example, you who are still alive, that true love will always prevail. It is obvious that there can be a yawning gap between that what is pictured as an ideal on one side and reality on the other side. Nobody disputes this. Neither is it the intention of what has proceeded to prove that the age of heathen Europe was an age in which love was the order of the day. The real point is to show that in the heathen society of Europe, true love between a man and a woman was put forward as the highest good, second maybe to death in battle. This is a better start than a society in which this ideal does not exist at all. And societies like this do exist too, as shall be shown. So the question of whether this is a high love ideal existed in the European heathendom can be answered positively. On the other hand, how real life looked is more difficult to answer. The fact that contemporary chroniclers and historians like to focus on wars and kings and not on ordinary things like daily life accounts for that. Nevertheless, readers of old writings sometimes come across interesting information. Well known, for instance, is the eulogy of the Roman historian Tacitus, which declares the way of the Teutonic nations loved and respected their wives. Quote, it stands on record that the armies already wavering and on the point of collapse have been rallied by the women, pleading heroically with their men, thrusting forward their bared bosoms, and making them realize the imminent prospect of enslavement, a fate which the Germans fear more desperately for their women than for themselves. Indeed, you can secure a sure hold on these nations if you compel them to include among a consignment of hostages some girls of noble family. More than this, they believe that there resides in women an element of holiness and a gift of prophecy, and so they do not scorn to ask their advice or lightly disregard their replies. Unquote. Even today, many people of European descent are still completely imbued with their ancestral love ideal. A lot of them tend to regard their wedding day as the most beautiful of their life, or to say it in a romantic way, in the heart of most white people, An age-old ballad is still resounding, the ballad of the two royal children. Quote, "It were two royal children, they loved each other so much." Unquote. For a large number of people with European roots, the love ideal is still something so obvious that many readers might have wondered during the preceding pages what the hell we're driving at. What are we driving at? Is this the love ideal, which is so deeply rooted in our heathen soul that we still regard it as something evident? Simply does not exist in the world of the Bible. It is lacking. It's just not there. The biblical world is a world without love. We mean love in the sense of romantic love, amor, and not in the sense of charity, caritas, solidarity towards other members of the group or sect. Indeed, nowhere in the Bible can one catch a glimpse of the romantic love ideal that is so characteristic of the old heathen European cultures, in which it plays a major role. One could count the beautiful Song of Solomon as an exception if it were not for the fact that the Jews and the Christians put an allegoric meaning on this song and interpret it as Yahweh people singing the praises of Yahweh, as if singing the praise singing the praises of love were something improper. Anyhow, Solomon's song does not go well with the Bible. It simply does not match. Therefore, it does not come as a surprise that exegetes ascribe it an Egyptian or Sumerian, that is, a heathen origin. So nowhere in the Bible world is there put forward something that can be compared with the European love ideal. But things are worse still. The Bible organizes everything in such a way that true love is simply made impossible. Things are like this. Probably no one will ever succeed in unlocking the mysteries of love. For what reason would that be needed in the first place? But one thing is sure, everyone knows that sentiments like these are only possible between people who respect each other. Mutual respect is, of course, not enough, but it is a conditio sine qua non, a necessary requirement. Without the mutual respect, love is simply impossible. Well, then, the biblical computer virus sees to it that this mutual respect cannot exist in the heads or the hearts of the people it has contaminated. Because mutual respect, let alone true love, cannot come into being or cannot remain when men are thought to think that they are superior to their women, and women are thought to regard themselves as servants of their husbands. In such a situation, nothing good can grow as far as love is concerned. But this is a very situation which the Bible brings about. In the first Bible book, Genesis, the message is clear from the start, from the fact that Eve had been created from a rib of Adam. The position of women as second-class humans is manifest. She comes secondly, in the most literal sense of the word, behind the numero uno, the man. And it is Yahweh himself who curses her when she has eaten from the forbidden fruit, and who condemns her to subordination to her husband. Quote, "He shall rule over thee." Further on in the book of Leviticus, it is stated that a girl is worth 50% of a boy. There Yahweh fixes the sums of money which are to be paid for redeeming persons who had been promised as offerings to Yahweh. Quote, "And thy estimation shall be of the male from 20 years old even unto 60 years old. Even thy estimation shall be 50 shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary. And if it be female, then thy estimation shall be 30 shekels, and if it be from 5 years old even unto 20 years old, then thy estimation shall be of the male 20 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. That a man counts for two women, also is the judgment of the Quran, which apparently has learnt this wisdom, like so many others, from the Bible. Quote, and accept the testimony of two of your men, but if there are no two men, one man and one, two women. The inferior and subordinate position of women in the world of Islam is well known. Less known is the inferiority and subjection, subordinate position of women in Jewish society nowadays. This is especially true as far as Orthodox Jews are concerned. Israeli professor Israel Shahak recounts in his book that a pious Jew in his daily morning prayers first praises Yahweh, not for having been created as a heathen, then he thanks him for not having been created as a slave, and in the third place he blesses the Lord for not having been born a woman. Now you know where all this shit comes from. In the New Testament, too, women play second fiddle in accordance to the spirit of Jewish tradition. The Apostle Paulus states, quote, for a man indeed ought to not cover his head, for so much as he is the image and the glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For the man is not the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for woman, but woman for the man. I often found it funny that, not funny, sort of tragic, that all my dealings with the skinheads over the years, a lot of them gravitated to Christian identity, in other words, that they were the real Jews, and they all loved this position of being over the women. They pushed them around, they'd marry them, girl would have a baby, and then down the road the skinhead would go. So all the time yelling and screaming against the Jews, these right-wing skinheads were actually fulfilling some of the highest positions of the Jews, which was quite interesting. In the gospel, women are urged more than once to be subservient to their husbands and to be silent. Quote, let your women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, and also saith the law, unquote. Right out of the Torah and the Talmud, and it's really got the extreme position under Islam and the Quran. I mean, you know, blacks complain about having been slaves, but women in Middle East are even worse than the black slaves had it here in the southern plantation. Just as harmful in promoting good relations with and respect for women is the truly morbid interest of the Bible and the Talmud show in uncleanliness of women during menstruation. This is done in a way that has nothing to do with hygiene. Rather, the intention is to humiliate women and create disgust for the female body. The Talmud book Nidah, for instance, seems to need no less than 509 pages to study the problem of menstruation. The Bible book Leviticus, for its part, tackles the subject in the following words. Quote, and if a woman have an issue, let her issue in her flesh be blood. She shall be put apart 7 days, and whosoever touches her shall be unclean until the even. And everything that she lieth upon in her separation shall be unclean. Everything also that she sitteth upon shall be unclean. And whosoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. And whosoever touches anything that she sat upon shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until even. And if it be on her bed or on anything wherein she sitteth, when she touches it, she shall be unclean until the even. And if any man lie with her at all, and her flour be upon him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and all the bed whereon he lieth shall be unclean. That's the whacked out Jews, and it spilled right over into Christianity. Spiritual Jewry. The Quran does not lay it on a stick as the Bible and the Talmud do. It is nevertheless infected with the same mentality and puts being ill and going to the toilet on a par with touching women. Quote, and if you are ill or traveling or you are coming from the toilet or you have touched women. In short, the world of the Bible, women are supposed to be inferior, subordinate, and dirty. There's no need to be a psychologist to understand that this is not the right breeding ground for a warm relationship. As it were, to illustrate this, the Bible dishes up some tales which are typical of the loveless way in which women are treated in the Bible and which are scandalous from the viewpoint of Europeans, but apparently not from that of the Bible. Well, let's see. I think that's about it for today. And I think it's fitting I read that in lieu of this is today. Today, the Freya's Day, in honor of our she-wolves. So, she-wolves, any guy gives you trouble, tell him to call me and I'll quote the raven, nevermore. 14:05. Be back. What is today? Friday, Saturday. I'll be back tomorrow. 14:05. One further comment. This is the reason, talking about women, when a strong, understanding white man should become absolutely furious with rage whenever he sees a nice-looking white woman with a nigger.
Now there are men who make history, there are men who change the world, and there are men like me that simply find the right girl. And in that very moment, it all becomes clear what I'm meant to do, the reason I'm here. Now every night I thank the Lord I found you, and every time I put my arms around you, I feel like the frame that gets to hold the Mona Lisa. If that's all I ever do, it never fails. We walk in a room, nobody sees me, they're all looking at you. I disappear, but that's fine with me. I feel the same way, you're all I can see. Now they've written books about Da Vinci's muse. Now I know it wasn't, but it should have been you. 'Cause I feel like the frame gets to hold the Mona Lisa, and I don't care if that's all I ever do. That's all I